All right, so this class is on the thought of Augustine, 13 weeks, just like the Ten Commandments class. And this first week will be called Augustine Transcends Manichaean Dualism, and I'll explain what both of those terms are in just a little bit. But just a couple introductory notes. I did send the syllabus, and if anybody wants a copy of that, just give me your email address if I don't have it. I already got one more. The more email addresses I have, the better, and then we can send you the weekly notes on Tuesday. I try to get them out by noon every Tuesday before the class. And I'll send you the syllabus that next time as well. So 13 weeks, just to give you a couple of references, we have the main works of Augustine in the church library. They look like this, with this spine. It's part of a larger set that I think Philip Schaff edits. So the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers, Augustine's writings are in there. But if you read them, since they're part of a set, and very aesthetically pleasing set, please read them here. And if you must take them out, please sign them out and don't take more than a month reading them. Because if it takes you that long to read any of them, it's typically because you're not reading them. For home study, though, I would recommend personally the CCEL online, if you're not familiar with that, Christian Classic Ethereal Library. It's a good resource, and you can get free copies if you don't mind staring at a screen. You can get free copies that way. Our textbook for this class is this book by Henry Chadwick. It's called Augustine, A Very Short Introduction, which I think is more than sufficient if you have a busy schedule. I think it's a pretty good synopsis of Augustine's thought. So let's see here. There's less than 13 chapters in here. So it's a pretty good, let's see here, just over 100 pages, 120 pages. So I think you'll find that very manageable and readable if you get a copy of that on Amazon or whatever. So there you go. Like Josh said, have a couple tests. If you're taking the class for credit, you got those tests. And the 2-to-5-page essay at the end, just hand that in the last day of the class. But again, if you're not taking it for credit, just come here and enjoy and benefit from the time. All right. Week one is Augustine Transcends Manichaean Dualism. I have the map right here. That's basically a map of Augustine's world that he lived in. And I'm really focusing on four cities in particular, which you'll hear about as we go on and we do Augustine's biography. You'll see why each of those features prominently in his life. Augustine's dates are 354 to 430 A.D. And he was arguably the greatest Christian thinker of the first millennium, but he actually had to get over some bad thinking from his own past in order to get there. And that's pretty similar to all of us. We've got to cleanse out that bad thinking, that pagan thinking from our mind. And as I said, the outline right here, this is where we're going today. First, we're going to do a brief biography of Augustine. The things we leave out on purpose because we're going to cover them in those particular weeks more at length. We're going to get into Manichaeanism 101, and that is spelled so many different ways by different authors. Don't worry about it. Sometimes they'll call them the Manichees. That was typically the contemporary way of labeling them. Well, my spell checker doesn't recognize that, but it does recognize this, so we're going to go there. Manichaeanism 101. We'll tell you what it is. And then the briefest sections, but I think one of the most practical for us, is Augustine's positive argument against Manichaeanism and his negative argument. You say, what do I care about Manichaeanism? Well, stick around because you might recognize it. You might recognize it in your neighbors and you might recognize it in your church neighbors. So let's get into this brief biography of Augustine. The Roman world in the end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century, and North African culture that Augustine was born into was a place that was disintegrating. It was disintegrating philosophically. Again, another lesson for Christian apologists and Christian in general today is that postmodernism isn't really saying anything new. The Greek and the Roman world was at the same place as Christ came into the world that we're in right now. People were more and more and more skeptical that you could know the truth. The reigning philosophical schools were becoming more and more skeptical. And that was the case still by the 4th century. The greatest theologians of the Western Church, at least between the turn of the 3rd century and the end of the 4th century, so almost for about 200 years, were all North Africans. They were the best theologians, Clement and Origen and Athanasius out of Alexandria, and Lactantius and Tertullian and Cyprian in Carthage. And Carthage is right here. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Alexandria would be, right about here, at the delta of the Nile, going up into the Mediterranean. So that's that. But it would be over here in Western Africa, situated across the Mediterranean from Italy. But Constantine's empire was always coming apart at the seams, and for a brief few years, under the grip of Julian the Apostate, who attempted to return the West to its pagan roots, that was in the 360s. But by 389, the Christians had regained control. Theodosius had resolved to take Constantine's secularized Catholic vision and impose Christian faith universally, and so unite against the barbarians at the northern gate. That's important throughout really the first few centuries, is that Christianity never really universally takes hold. Even where it does take hold, as we're going to see, Augustine had to come in and re-Christianize the area, as there had been some heresies coming here. But there's barbarians at the gates, north of the Danube over here, and then north of the Alps. These are not Christianized at all. Okay? So you had this frontier, and the pressure was on Constantine and Theodosius, reigning from over here at Constantinople, to unify a West and an Eastern Empire for political reasons. And that has a lot to do with a lot of the pagan intrusions that came into the Christian faith. But Augustine, his family and his hometown background, and so these dates are more 354 to 366, his childhood, growing up around Carthage. His parents, Patrick was a pagan and Monica was a Christian. In fact, so this is where Augustine is growing up. It's actually a smaller town around Hippo called Thagaste. And this town in Latin was Hippo Regius. And Augustine grew up in more of a sort of a backwater village, I guess you could say, outside of Hippo. And his mother, in spite of the fact that she was married to a pagan, had converted to Christ. And she is portrayed in the Confessions and in a lot of historians as sort of a, I would call her a saintly stalker. But in a very affectionate way, she always prayed for Augustine for years. For his conversion, he pictures her as someone who is almost omnipresent, who understands his soul, who is putting up with his nonsense as a young man, vainly pursuing pagan riches, and who never gives up on him. And that's a lesson, because one of the most beloved characters in the Christian imagination throughout the Middle Ages is someone who is always assuming, and Augustine keeps using this language in the Confessions, she considered me as a dead man. She considered me dead. So considering me dead, she prayed for me. Now if you do that today, you're considered judgmental. But Monica was considered saintly for that reason. And he spoke of her almost as an angel on earth. Well, in spite of being unequally yoked, Patrick and Monica agreed on one thing, and that was a good education. And that meant, in a culture of vain eloquence in North Africa, rhetoric. So rhetoric was the thing to do, mostly for the sake of law. But not for Augustine. He thought about that. He thought about vain riches and being in politics once he got up to Milan, and we'll get to that in a second. But mostly it was for the sake of eloquence, for being light, for being sharp, for destroying your opponents, or for writing things and stuff like that. People looking at you, it's a different world than the world we live in. We got all these gadgets and everything. But up until about two or three generations before us, people read these things, they were called books. And when they read them, they actually were prepared to change their whole life and way of doing things because of lines in reasoning that were in these things. And you would achieve fame, so you would have bad motives in doing that as well. And so Augustine did. He said in the Confessions that when he first went over to Hippo to start studying all these things, and then to Carthage, I hated Greek, but I loved the Latin works. And he especially loved the works of Cicero. He joined this sect that we're going to talk about today called the Manichaeans in 371, and he actually stayed with them for about a dozen years, though not all of that time was he, you know, impressed by them. He knew that they couldn't answer all of the major questions of life. He took a concubine that he held onto for 15 years in 372, and he even had a son with her. And he taught briefly in Rome, and then in 383 was offered a better position in Milan. So if we could do a little Indiana Jones thing, you know, when the music's going and he goes from one place to another, it would kind of look like this. He went from here to here to here, and then back to, and then over to Rome, and then very briefly, and then he was offered a better position in 383 in Milan to teach rhetoric. So all the people in the empire that were going to be anybody had to pass through people like Augustine to learn how to basically triumph over your opponents and win friends and all that good stuff through the way that he taught rhetoric. At any rate, by 384, he had seen a lot of the fallacies contained in the Manichaean system, which we'll talk about. But the way that he saw it was through another school that we're going to talk about next time, that's next week, called Neoplatonism. And the ideas of Plato, originally, then filtered down through their main teacher, Plotinus, in the century before Augustine, helped him understand some things that were basically more monotheistic than a lot of the Christians that he had learned Christianity from were. And that helped him understand a lot of the simple ways that he had been taught to view the Bible through. And so he had a reputation for Manichaeanism. Now, it didn't make him converted, but it was something that God would use. He was converted and called to ministry in 386 and 387, in those 2 years. When he went to Milan, first of all, you have to understand that when he left for Rome the first time, he actually had to fake leaving the beach because his mother Monica followed him there, hanging on to him like this. And he said, well, I'll go in the morning. I'm just helping my friend board up right now. And then in the morning, he steals away and goes into Rome and breaks his mother's heart. Well, guess what? She followed him. And so she went all the way to Milan. And she happened to start going to a church there with the best pastor and the best preacher in the world at that time, a guy named Ambrose. And Augustine said, all right, fine, I'll listen to this guy preach. And don't forget, Augustine is the leading teacher of rhetoric in the Roman Empire. And when he hears Ambrose preach, he's absolutely captivated. Not by everything. He thought he had his arguments, but he was captivated by the way that he read the Scriptures in a way that he really didn't think you could read the Scriptures, drawing a deeper spiritual meaning about eternal truths out of all the things that he would just dismiss as mere stories. And so under the influences of preaching in 386, one day him and a friend, who was also a Manichaean, you know, they were reading Romans 13. They wanted to compare Paul to Plato, in a sense. And as he was reading Romans 13 with his friend, Alypius, he shoves down the Bible in his mother's house, and he runs out to the garden, as the story goes in the Confessions, and he's bothered, and he says to his friend, what is the matter with us? We are reading these things about virtue and about the soul, and we're heathens. We can't subdue our flesh. We can't control ourselves. And these simple peasants, as long as they're Christians, and he used the phrase, taking heaven by storm, which is Watson's phrase that he used in that book, but Augustine used that phrase there. So what's wrong with us? And so he gets away from his friend even further. He goes into the garden, and he breaks down. He can't control it. And that's something you wouldn't share. First of all, there was no real autobiography back then in the ancient world. It was really the first autobiography in the Western world, where he's just bearing his soul, doing this introspection. And he's relaying this, how he's just crying at this point. And he hears from the yard next to him these children's voices, this sing-songy type thing, except in Latin it was tole lege, which means take up and read, take up and read. And so he took that as a message from God, and he goes back into the house, and he says, where were we? And he goes right back to Romans 13. And his friend read a slightly different verse than he did, but he read in Romans 13:14 about making no provision for the flesh, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ. And so, you know, people are converted at some weird verses sometimes, and sometimes some ones that aren't weird, but it's just like, how did that verse lead to your conversion? But it did, because he realized that putting on the Lord Jesus Christ, in some way, was an infinitely more powerful way to destroy sin. He knew his own sin. He had been led to see that. Well, he was baptized by Ambrose on Easter Sunday in 387, and selected to be a presbyter of the church in Hippo, so he goes back home in 391, and then selected to be bishop of the same city in 395. So, back here by 391. And there was some stuff that was happening, which we'll get to, some studies of his, some books of his, which we'll get to maybe next time. But the Manichaean error was everywhere back home when he got there. And nobody was better suited to refute them than the now prestigious Augustine. The Donatists, a group we're going to talk about in week 4, I think, were also strongest there. And therefore, the bulk of Augustine's apologetic at this time was a defense of certain Christian doctrines against those two groups. He was defending things like the goodness of God and creation, which was under attack, the incarnation, and the Catholicity of the church, small c. We'll get back to that too. And the African bishops were delighted to have him on their team. In all of this, Augustine was being a bishop. He was being a pastor, a shepherd of a whole region. And again, that's another lesson for our day. North African Christianity had become overrun with Manichaean and Donatist errors. In other words, true Christianity receded throughout the century before he was there. By this time, true Christianity, which had landed there a century and a half before, had kind of withered away, dissipated, and these other errors were becoming the Christianity that people knew back there. You know, like in every generation that's ever been. Okay, so there's a lesson there as well. If you divide up Augustine's career, you can actually see different polemical phases. At the very beginning, probably from the very beginning, let's just call it 391 to about 404, it's really Augustine against Manichaeism, let's just put the Manichaeists, and against the Donatists. Most of his writings are taken up correcting these errors that people in his region had. Why was he doing this? Because he was bishop of the region. He was shepherd over the churches of North Africa. So he's protecting them from these false views. Well, throughout the rest of his life, he's occupied against still the Donatists, but then another heresy that we will start to talk about, at least by 410, Pelagianism. So you can kind of divide up his polemical career in that way. Between the authorship of his two most famous works, The Confessions in 396 and The City of God, which he started writing in 412, Augustine had shed perhaps the most powerful pagan idea that had gripped his own heart prior to conversion, and that was the idea that the power of sin could be eradicated in this life. He began to see, through all his wrestling with the Manichaeists, wrestling them from without, and wrestling his own sin from within, that the overarching questions of God's goodness and God's sovereignty were not so divorced from the practical questions of one's own goodness and will and responsibility after all. So these things are all you're going to see. If you're here for all 13 weeks, you will see how incredibly practical all these supposedly highfalutin ideas are. But it was the City of God which has become his ultimate crown in writing, and really the ultimate book in Christian thought written in the first millennium of the church. On August 24th, 410, an army of Goths entered Rome and set fire to most of the city. Well, Augustine originally wrote this as a letter to a guy named Marcellinus who was serving in the government, a Christian. And so what began as a defense against the pagan accusation that Christianity is to be blamed for the fall of Rome, the pen of Augustine turned upward and outward to a comprehensive Christian vision of all things. In 23 books, The City of God moves from a critique of the pagan culture, a critique of the incoherence of their so-called gods and their moral bankruptcy, to an impressive history of both secular and sacred realms from the beginnings of civilization to the present, and then a comparison of the two cities, the heavenly and the earthly city, as to their ultimate objects, which animate the two souls, and in fact, finally, to their two ultimate destinies. Augustine's basic argument in The City of God is that anything good the pagan philosophers ever uttered found their fulfillment in Christ, and anything else they ever said met their refutation by the Christian philosopher. The book did nothing less than to make Christianity and true reason absolutely inseparable and banished the pagan mind to the cultural backwoods proper to the name pagan. And so for 1,500 years, Christians thought in terms of the way Augustine argued in The City of God. And as that was rejected, so Christianity lost its influence. That's the order of things. All right, I talked a little bit about Pelagianism already, so I'm going to skip that. We're going to do a whole week on the various heresies, Donatism, Pelagianism, and so on. But for Augustine, to have a bigger doctrine of God was instantly to have a bigger appreciation for the church. The group that I mentioned called the Donatists believed that baptism performed by illegitimate ministers or church members, and especially bishops, who had lapsed during the persecution, they had a word for it, the Donatists did. They called them the lapsi. Those who had refused to confess Christ or buckled under the pressure. In other words, so once the persecutions ended and the Edict of Milan in 312 and Christianity was accepted everywhere, the question became, do we let these guys back into the church? And of course, the Donatists raised the question and answered, no, the church is the pure. Okay, and so that became the Donatism heresy. And when you hear that, that's the context of the usage of the word Catholic in Augustine's vocabulary. And that's the way we're going to use it, as universal. But we're aware of how the Roman Catholic Church began to use Catholicity as essentially a physical, geographical thing, which is naturalistic. It's no longer a monotheistic worldview when you have that doctrine of the Church. So the kind of things we're going to be thinking about. How is this particular doctrine, which you may not have thought is a major worldview piece, how is that either a theistic or anti-theistic assumption behind that? Is it a monotheistic or a pantheistic assumption behind that? That's what people like Augustine get us to think about and help us to think about. It's been said that the Catholicism in the Middle Ages would be a preference of Augustine's doctrine of the Church, while the Reformation would be the preference of Augustine's doctrine of grace. That's another thing we're going to see. In the very last week, we're going to do a week called Choose Your Own Augustine, because everybody seems to want to claim Augustine to be their own, except for modern liberals and other people who will also have a section in that week devoted to them. We'll talk about a monergistic Augustine, a synergistic Augustine, an early Augustine, a late Augustine, a repressed, prudish Augustine, an over-intellectualized, dualistic Augustine. We'll talk about all those different misconceptions of him, uncharitable ways to read him. Okay? But I think it's partially accurate, at least to say, that Rome would be a result of preferring Augustine's doctrine of the Church, which we have some problems with, but not complete problems with, and the Reformation would be a preference of Augustine's doctrine of grace, which of course we're going to celebrate and point out. His reflections on the nature of time have impressed unbelieving philosophers down to the present day, and his hermeneutical approach is something we're going to do a whole week on, because his doctrine of Scripture and his doctrine of how words in Scripture are signs to real things, again, makes or breaks whether or not you will be a monotheist or whether you will treat the Bible as a kind of superstitious Ouija board and think that you're being more faithful to it by treating the words as ends in themselves. So we'll get into that as well. He writes a book called On Christian Doctrine where he talks about that. Skip some stuff here. At the end of his life, he had written two works that show his full circle turn toward total divine grace. He was not always what we would today call a Calvinist, although if you were in Calvin's time, you would have been accused of being an Augustinian as opposed to Pelagian. Except even there, that probably wouldn't work, because every Catholic understood that Augustine was right and Pelagius was wrong. Well, that's kind of the way that doctrine is played in every generation. The heretics will try to... R.C. Sproul calls it studied ambiguity. In other words, you play with words. You don't maintain the heresy. You play with words. And you accuse people of being uncharitable with words. And Sproul says, so that the serpent can slither on his belly in the vineyard for another day. You know, it's a way of flying under the radar screen without admitting this is my position. And so you quibble over words and labels and charity and stuff like that. But at the end of his life, he had written two books that show that Augustine had come full circle to a monergistic, grace alone view of salvation. Those two books in 429 are on the predestination of the saints and on the gift of perseverance. And you can already see this doctrine as early as In the City of God in 412. You can see a full monergistic view. But even his early writings, he's not a silly humanist as what would come in the Pelagian stream of thought. But he wrote these books. At this time, during this year, more barbarians were at the gates. In the summer of 429, an army of 80,000 Vandals, not the ones from Moscow, these are the real Vandals that win their games. But anyway, Vandals from eastern Germany crossed the Straits of Gibraltar along with other Goths who had joined them in order to take the last crown jewel of the old Roman order. It would take them 10 years total to subdue the region into their own kingdom, and they would sack Rome again in 455. As the Vandals shut down churches and violated the most basic human rights of the North African townspeople, Augustine worked away in his last writings, knowing that he wouldn't live more than another few weeks. Many of his friends had been killed one after another, and it was now in 430, and Augustine died of the fever. And the Arian Christian Vandals had swept through all of North Africa, replacing one form of faith with another. Again, after this time, it was Arian Christianity. Very short blip that Christianity actually came back. And by the time, again, as you go to the university, another mythology, you've got to pay attention to these things. Hey, that doesn't add up with what's presented to me. You know how Christians burned all the books that would have been unfavorable to their position? You know, if you watch the Hitler Channel around Easter time? Just one little problem with that. There's actually a few, but here's one that we've run into right here. There was never Christianity at the boundary of this empire. It never took root. In other words, between the Arians taking over North Africa, they already had, all these barbarians were converted to Arianism. Even before Arius, even before he was condemned as a heretic earlier in that century. And so, at the gates, Christians were Arians. They weren't Christians if they were Arians and denied the deity of Christ. But at any rate, they came in there by the 5th century. Well, what happens 2.5 centuries later? Islam. And they come in here and they take over, and they take over the Moors, and then they come into southern Spain. So when's this glorious time that the church can burn all these books? Okay, see me afterwards and let's talk about that. Just things you got to pay attention to history and make you realize, wait a minute, that makes the secular thesis absolutely mindless. It doesn't even add up. Okay, so pay attention to that stuff when you run into it in history. All right, let's get into this. Manichaeism 101. What was this thing that Augustine was getting beyond? Well, as a system, let me do some erasing now. I'm going to put three words up here that are going to, I think, perfectly describe what Manichaeism was. It was these three things. It was marked by these three things. It was naturalistic. And this is what you should start putting the antennas up for when I said, is there a Manichaeism today? And does it call itself Christian? So it's natural, so be listening. Naturalistic, dualistic, and three, pantheistic. Boy, that's three strikes, right? Those are all non-Christian things. Well, here's how it all happened. The Medo-Persian Empire, way out east, had fused an ancient religion called Zoroastrianism. It was basically the main religion of the Babylonians. From somewhere on the border between the Near East and the Far East, that religion of Babylon, it was basically Zoroastrianism comes all the way from the Tower of Babel. I'm pointing, but it would be way down there where that plug is, pretty much. But the original religion of Babylon was the cult of Marduk. Actually, Nimrod claimed himself to be that god. And that was their religion, and that became Zoroastrianism. It's where all demonic things in the world now come from, the Tower of Babel. An ancient religion, you could trace it right back to that. I don't want to get conspiracy theory on here or anything like that. But that's where all those ancient religions come from originally. In fact, the word Babel, before it was used mocking by the Hebrews, that you're babbling, meant the gate of the gods. The word El in all the Semitic languages means God, that's why. And all is what they changed it to in Arabic. But at any rate, Zoroastrianism comes from that. Well, these Persians come from even further in the East and are merging a lot of their Eastern Oriental ideas with that idea. And don't forget, this is the time Alexander's empire had split apart, Rome took over, and then the Roman Empire went that way. And what happens when your civilization goes this way, typically, if you're a human being and you're really lazy? While the empire goes that way and things are turning up roses and everything's getting stronger and more solidified, actually it's diffusing. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, but as a matter of fact, human beings are really shallow. And the better things get, the lazier we get in our brains. It's called intellectual sloth. And as the Greeks and the Romans are turning inward in their philosophy, giving up on Plato and Aristotle's idea that you can actually know truth, you can know eternal form the way things are, by the end of the 3rd century, 2nd century BC, the dominant religions become cynical, skeptical, and so on. And that lasts all the way into the time of Augustine. So as the Roman Empire is spreading itself thin and has nothing cultural to hold it together, nothing sufficient, there's a perfect vacuum to come in with ideas that are really shallow, but to them look pretty sophisticated. You know, like Americans like Zen Buddhism, like we put together Buddhism and some ideas, commercialistic, we let Oprah sell it, and it looks really profound. You know, Phil Jackson, and well, those guys look smart, so maybe actually it's really, really stupid, and you could decimate it within 30 seconds or less, but it looks really profound because they don't have all the embarrassing warts of Western man, and so it looks humble, it looks cool. But actually, it's really quite stupid. And that's the first time this has happened. It's happened at that time. In the 3rd century AD, there was a guy named Mani. And his writings, because he doesn't have any writings, nothing survives, and so he's not going to concern us so much except just to show you where the name came from, Manichaeism. But what he actually grows up in a Christian background. He has a Persian father, but he claims an angelic visitation. Oh, that was so original when Muhammad did that. He claims an angelic... By the way, Galatians 1:8, even if we were an angel from heaven... So, angel from heaven alert, you know, should have gone off with Manny, Muhammad, Joseph Smith. If we or an angel from heaven give you another testimony to Jesus Christ on the front of your book, and that's what it says, huge red flag should be going off. But he claims an angelic visitation, and he actually claims that he is the fulfillment of the paraclete that Jesus promised. Muhammad kind of did something like that too. You kind of hear that in Muslim ideas, that he was the one to come. Anyway, he's talking about the Holy Spirit. That's who he's talking about. But he claims to be the mouthpiece of the Holy Spirit. It was sometime between 238 and 252 AD. But here's what's important for us, is the system. In this new philosophy religion, light and darkness were both ultimate substance. So, there's two ways you can look at this, and both are going to wind up in pantheism. One of the ideas, you can say, you can kind of horizontalize it. You have two equal and opposite forces. Let's just call it the force. But we won't call it the force. There's just two equal and opposite forces. We won't call it yin and yang either. That's Eastern. You say, no, I don't believe that. I believe the light is superior to the darkness. But here's the problem with that. Those ideas came from Neoplatonists, and Plotinus, their major Neoplatonists, called the ultimate being the One. And all of creation was an emanation from Him. And in a sense, He would never even do this on purpose, because this world contains evil and stuff like that. But the problem with that is that leads to creation being necessary. So let's put the word necessary up here. So even though you've verticalized this thing between God and the world, you have not separated God from the world. God and the world are equally necessary. Good and evil are equally necessary. How many times do you ask Christians, why did God create the world? Well, I don't know, because he needed to stop. I don't care how you end that sentence. You have started it very badly. Why did he create you? Well, he wanted to experience love. So he didn't experience love before he created you? What about the Trinity? Well, I've never thought about that before. Okay, and so what all those things are saying, well, he needed evil to do something with good. He wanted to play chess or something. And he's just a really, really, really good chess player. Really smart, really knows the future, but he needed. Now, however you say that, that concept of the necessity between the Creator and the creation makes the Creator and the creation one thing, where the creation is in some way causing something in the Creator, and that is pantheism. Dualism immediately, logically implies pantheism. Two or more, if you say pluralism, equal and opposite forces are mutually interdependent causes, and that is pantheism, where all is God. Pantheism just means pan, meaning all or everything, and theos meaning God. So, you're going to have the same thing with naturalism. If nature is all there is, you have that. So, either way you get there, you get there. And as we'll see in Manichaeans' practices, we'll see things that are naturalistic. Okay, so light and darkness played a very key role in the imagery and the language that they used. They were both ultimate substances. Each of these ultimate substances had five basic attributes, not really important, but they would parallel the eons in Gnosticism. So, Gnosticism kind of came before Manichaeanism and probably infused a lot of their ideas into it as well. Gnostics and Manichaeans both got a lot of their ideas from Neoplatonists. Now, light is obviously good in this setup and darkness is evil, so they're going to think they agree with us on that. But again, what is not so obvious is how we go about calling which one is good and the other evil. And that is the way C.S. Lewis argued in Mere Christianity against dualism is... Here's a problem. How do you go about calling one good and the other evil? Except by your own preference. I happen to prefer that one to that one. Killing over saving. But that's completely arbitrary in the sense of irrational or uncaused or whimsical to call one good and the other evil. In fact, they're both equal and opposite forces. That's a problem. And this problem makes up the whole Manichaean cosmology and ethics. From these two forces come two natures all the way down, two orders, two kingdoms. And see what the devil does is he copies something that's inauthentic. He inauthenticates the authentic to scare people away from the authentic thing. You're going to see two orders, two kingdoms. When you get to Augustine on City of God, you might say, so let me say it for you to preempt, wait a minute, I wonder if Augustine retained that idea from the Manichaeans, and they were wrong, so maybe he's wrong too. There's not two, you know, there are two forces, but they're not equal and opposite. They are opposite, but they're not equal. Okay, between light and darkness, there's no mixing because God is light and in Him is no darkness at all. The difference, though, is how to transcend this. So when I called this one today, Augustine transcends the dualism of Manichaeanism, I'm not just talking about he transcends in a figurative way. He gets over it in his own personal walk. He rises above it. That's true, too. But I mean something philosophical by that. I mean that however you see the world, if everything in your world is inside this box or circle, then you have no ultimate reason for anything in this circle. Everything is a mindless mass or collection of disconnected things that have no ultimate meaning. There's nothing to unify them. There's no universal truth that stands over them. So that's what I mean by transcend. You need a transcendent truth that brings unity to this thing and this thing. Why do I call this one good and this one evil? This one may be in the middle not so good, and so on and so forth. I need something that transcends the system. So the Manichaean error moves a lot of the biggest problems in life downward. Why should evil exist in the first place? Why is anyone capable of knowing the good, yet incapable of subduing evil? The attempt to answer such questions without transcending that ultimate duality leads to many absurdities. Ultimately, a blending of the good and the bad. Now, how did this play out in their practical life? Well, for the Manichaeans, man is only good to the degree that he can overcome the passions of the body. And woman is evil by being the body that most captivates the fleshly passions of the man. So, you see how that works out? So here you have a carbon copy of Gnostic salvation. I'm going to be saved by overcoming this thing that I can do on my own. I can think about this and so escape the pleasures of the body. There's a hint of biblical truth in there about the pleasures of the body and the passions of the flesh. Paul talks about that a lot, setting your mind on the things of the Spirit. So the devil does. He copies enough of the real thing to scare you away from the real thing. But in addition to that Gnostic idea, you have an even more chauvinistic sexual repression in the Manichaean system. And so you have to keep that in mind when Augustine is writing his Manichaean writings. You're going to lift quotes out of context and say, man, that guy Augustine was a real prude. Okay, well, read it in context and see who he's arguing against and why he's making this particular point. Now, Augustine fell in with the Manichaean sect for a decade, even though he had been studying classical literature at the same time, as well as the latest on science. And therefore, it was for him more of a moral philosophy, which was disconnected from ultimate commitment. When Augustine was 29 and still a student in Carthage, the world's best-known teacher of philosophy, a guy named Faustus, paid a visit to town. It was 383. And everybody said, well, now you're going to have all your questions answered. We're going to fly in. You know, plane. We're going to sail in. The best teacher among us, this guy named Faustus, he'll help you out. Well, Augustine found this guru thoroughly unimpressive and rejected the system on the ground of its shallow cosmology and its ineffective moral program. For all of its venom against the physical flesh, Manichaeans could not subdue the passions. And that was a big deal. It might surprise you, because when you think of non-believing thinkers today, you don't think of people who are trying to subdue the passions. But for a classical pagan, one of the biggest subsections of philosophy was how to subdue the passions, because they believed, along with Plato and Aristotle, that we are on this earth, we are in this life to think about things. Our soul is the most excellent part of us, and what's going to get in the way are things that are more like animals. The overindulgence of food or you know, whether it's sexual relations or anything really, the pursuit of fame, though that's slightly more invisible of a thing, but the idea was that those things that make you more like an animal are, and again, that is a theistic, but it's consistent with the biblical truth, but they got that from general revelation. They didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know what sin was, even though they were sinners like everybody else. So they devalued, had a low view of what's the role that sin played. But at any rate, Augustine wasn't ready to turn to full Christianity. Instead, he would embrace this thing that I called Neoplatonism. So Augustine makes two arguments against Manichaeanism. These arguments are in no particular order throughout his anti-Manichaean writings. And I think I have the anti-Manichaean writings in very small print listed out, only to give you an idea of how many there were. I'm not going to mention them right now, but if you just take a look at that list, I'll give you an idea. Wow, he really thought this was a big problem, and he devoted a lot of literature and arguments against them. So what do I mean by the positive argument? That's our third point. Well, basically, he reasons from the necessity of an ultimate good that, again, transcends the created order. So this circle is going to represent the created world, the physical universe, everything in it, earth, bodies, and even our own thoughts. So it's not simply visible and invisible. So that's the first thing you got to get. It's not this caricature where Augustine's just copying all the Platonists, and everything that's invisible is up here, and everything that's visible is down here. Well, up and down are kind of relative terms here, aren't they? Because where is the soul? You know, it's almost a wrong question to begin with, this whole idea of awareness, because that's a physical thing. So just don't think about that right now. All we're doing is saying that the ultimate good has to, in a sense, be above particular instances of good. And so this is going to be the essence of good from the Latin esse, which means being. And particular instances or examples or expressions of good. And here's maybe a good picture, and this is going to be oversimplified, but it's a good picture of what Augustine is going to, he's going to agree with the Platonists on this point. So if I take a circle inside the circle, and I'm going to shadow the bottom of it that's facing away from the light, from the sun, from this word good, it's going to be revealing itself this way, coming off of the top side, as just as an earth, the earth would be in relation to the sun. The side that's facing the sun would be lit up, we call that day. The side that's away from the earth at that time would be night. So in the same way, picture it now, it's, a circle is just representing this thing. This thing could be a person's character. This thing could be a person's action. Or anything else in all creation that God says, for example, it is good. It is good. He said about man and woman, it is very good. And the other key thing to see is that as this thing is falling away, that falling away is what he will call evil. And all of Augustine's, especially his early thoughts on the difference between good and evil, and where, you know, where does evil come from? Well, you have to define what good is first. Augustine would have no problem with the problem of evil, and he addressed it. But why is he thinking this? Because he's dealing with these Manichaeans that had a false view of it. He's going to reason from the necessity of a chief good to the entire order of good and evil things in nature and in history. Now, Augustine knows that his opponents claim to share a common assumption. And this is very important in arguing with anybody. Find the common assumption, even if they don't really mean it consistently, and work from there. Find your point of departure. Don't compare apples and oranges with the Mormon, for example, who's arguing from a different book than you are. You're comparing apples and oranges. Find the point of departure, even if they're insincere about it. Well, that common assumption that he knew they claimed to hold is the basic philosophy of Plato, with its distinctions between knowledge and opinion, between the essential form or essence of a thing versus the world of appearances. But Augustine also knew that the Manichaeans do not, in fact, consistently believe this. They can't. If they did, they would not have a duality of equals. They wouldn't have two equal and opposite things in this universe. So he operates off of an axiom, an assumption, that agrees with Plato and all of the subsequent Platonists. And that first principle is that being equals goodness. Notice the difference between this and saying, for example, what Nietzsche or somebody else would say, that whatever is ought to be. Is equals ought. And there you have a kind of fatalism that says whatever will be, will be. And there is nothing beyond that. Well, if naturalism is true, all you have is that circle. Everything in nature. There isn't anything else that exists. So if I say that whatever is down here is the way it ought to be, that really is tyrannical. Because there's no better way that it could be. Okay? Now we're going into the deep end of the pool here, and we'll come back to this throughout this class. But the Platonists, Plato believed that there had to be, in order for any of our words to make sense about justice or beauty or goodness or anything else, there had to be these invisible, eternal, unchanging things. The good, the just, the beautiful, in order for us to call something down here beautiful. And he would say that thing, that flower isn't beauty itself, it's participating in beauty. It's participating in being for the same reason that that table is participating in light. What you see is brown and flat and so on is the light. It's participating in its reflective good. It's not good in itself. You say, wow, this is really interesting, but that guy's a pagan, so I'm really distracted right now. Well, what about Jesus in Luke chapter 18 when the rich young ruler comes up to him? And he says, good teacher, lowercase g. And Jesus' response is a response to the fact that he made that error and he knew it. Good teacher. What did Jesus say? Why do you call me good? God alone is good. Is Jesus denying that he's God? No, of course not. He knows that this guy has a very cavalier attitude about he didn't know who he was talking to. He said, why do you call me good? Good teacher. He's just another teacher, in other words. Why do you call me good if I'm just another good teacher? God alone is good. He said, what's my side dude be saved, in a sense? I've obeyed all the commandments. What does Jesus say? So in other words, he's saying, I've obeyed all these good things. He says, one thing you lack. So what did Jesus do? He makes a distinction between the good things in this world and the only thing that makes them good. The many things that this guy did and the one thing that he should do. Did Jesus get this from Plato? No, Plato got it from Jesus. That's what John 1 says, that the light was in the world before the incarnation, lighting up all men. Or as we say it cruelly today, the sun shines and the dog's behind some days. But what that means is that the pagan can actually get something right. It will not save him. It will probably not tend toward his salvation. It will tend toward his destruction, as Romans 1 says. Nevertheless, these things only glow down here because of this light up here. Now, Plato wouldn't have said it that way. But Augustine is agreeing with him so far. Such an assumption, being equals goodness, then forms a constellation of other necessary truths, as Chadwick in that book summarizes very well. He says, quote, he's summarizing Augustine's agreement with the Platonists, creation is participation in being. Is that true? Is creation a participation in God, a reflection of God, or does it stand on its own? Okay, oh, if you put it that way, well, that is what he said. That's theism. That's not pantheism. Creation, to the degree that it's good, is a reflective good. It's extrinsic good. It's not intrinsic good. Its goodness is not derived from itself. It is reflective of God's goodness or derivative of God's goodness. Creation is participation in being, Acts 17:28. In Him we live and move and have our being. Sorry, I'm interspersing my thoughts in with Chadwick. So Chadwick continues. This term implies derivation. It is characteristic of that which is derived. That what one has is then distinct from what one is. For creatures, it is one thing to exist, another to be just and wise. But in God, to exist and to be just and good and wise are one and the same. Man can exist without being just, good, or wise. I would add, not for long. But God cannot. God is what he has, end quote. So God is the only necessary being. As such, the very meaning of the word good is that which ought to be. In other words, that which is like God, that which is God, is good. Again, Jesus, Luke 18, God alone is good. Or, let's make it simple and practical. Bring back something Josh said about the law. Think about the first table of the law versus the second table. You see that right there? Same thing. The first table of the law is about what? You say God. Well, the second table of, and this is the first four commandments, the second table of the law is about what? Same thing, God, just outward. Man. Here, the difference is just the arrow of the command is directed Godward. You shall have no other God before me. No graven images. You not take the Lord's name in vain. Keep the Sabbath holy. And then you get down here and you see manward, but is it not still Godward? Why should you not kill somebody? Genesis 9:6, because man was made in God's image. Why should you do everything you do? Because of what it says about God. On that point, there would be full agreement with the Platonists. Because they're saying everything down here is entirely a participation in the being who is eternal. Skip some of that stuff. Here's another way to say it, and Augustine did, in another one of his books on the nature of the good. He summarizes it this way. He says, the highest good, than which there is none higher, is God. And consequently, He is unchangeably good. What makes something the supreme good? It can't be anything other than good. Unchangeably good. Hence, truly eternal and immortal. All other good things are only from Him, not of Him. In other words, not of the same essence. For what is of Him is Himself. And consequently, if He alone is unchangeable, all things that He has made, because He has made them out of nothing, are changeable. That, and Augustine's going to return to that when he finally starts getting monergism. Even when he writes his books on the freedom of the will against the Manichaeans, he realizes that the only reason things can be evil, if God, who's all-powerful and all-wise, made the universe, the only reason, the only explanation there can be for evil is if God turns out the lights and those things that are created ex nihilo go ad nihilo. Out of nothing, back to nothing. They have no ability to exist on their own because they're made out of what? Not star stuff, like Carl Sagan said. Nothing stuff. Nothing, nothing. If you're made out of nothing, and the one who's speaking you and upholding you in existence lets you go, what will you return to? Your own nature. Who will be doing that? Your own nature will. Your own nature is nothingness. Total explanation for everything. And Augustine's going to chew on that more as he goes on in his writing career. He says, because therefore no good things, whether great or small, through whatever gradations of things, can exist except from God. But since every nature, so far as it is a nature, is good, it follows that no nature can exist save from the Most High and true God. So, natures derive their goodness from that which is good, and that they exist is good. So, for example, that the damned continue to exist in a state of being punished in hell is good. Experientially, it is the height of bad. But that they exist is good. And Augustine's going to address that again. Everything that exists in its existence is good. In its participation in being, in God's purpose of upholding it, is good. This is evil. That which is lying about God at any point. Two main ways that Augustine will argue positively from ultimate good. I'll try to wrap up the positive argument in the next 5 minutes and we'll just save everything else. Two main ways that he argues positively from ultimate good. One is teleological and one is moral. So, one way to argue this way, positively from God to lower goods, is teleological, in other words, about purpose and end. Oh boy. What did I do? Oh boy. And the other is moral. From an assessment of the good and conformity to the good. So the teleological argument, I just mean, here's his argument, God as his own chief end makes every other chief end. So teleology, telos in the Greek, is end. Okay, so from God being his own chief end, you have the chief end of everything else. And then morally, how does he argue this way? God as supremely good makes the way things ought to be. What is the way things ought to be? Pick a thing. God. In what sense is it like God? Is it like God? So for example, a rock, you wouldn't blame for being blind because a rock is not a seeing thing. A rock's hardness is telling the truth about God. Something else would have to make it lie about God. But if you're a seeing thing and you close your eyes, you are wicked in the not wanting to behold what God wants you to behold. Okay, so that's going to be the moral argument. Everything else Augustine says against the Manichaeans is wrapped up in those two ways of arguing. I have a picture on your notes that pretty much shows you that direction from being to becoming. From the world of form, as Plato thought, to the world of appearances. Augustine would not call them forms. He wasn't simply baptizing Plato in scriptural language. He recognized that what Plato called forms are really the attributes of God or truths beheld in the mind of God. And that's going to become the medieval doctrine of realism, which is absolutely essential to the Christian worldview, rationality, and people not killing each other. And when that battle was lost in the late Middle Ages, Christianity blew its brains out before the Reformation ever happened. And if we do not reclaim the doctrine of realism, we will not have monotheism, because the two are just the same thing. If you want the ultimate biblical verse for realism, I can give you two, and they're just the famous general revelation verses. Psalm 19:1-3, Romans 1:20. Who is a realist in the seminary today? Pretty much nobody. It's attacked venomously on all sides by philosophical lightweights that shouldn't be teaching such things. What elements of Manichaeanism didn't square with this flow? Light and darkness being two equal and opposite forces, that's one that has to go. Foods or activities, good or bad, based on the matter, based on their situation, their external, that has to go, which is the doctrine of the suburbs today. The external appearance of man tells you whether he's been good or bad, you know, like Santa Claus. The external results, the way the room is situated right now, tells you whether or not the man's been faithful. That comes from that naturalistic worldview, and in fact is naturalism. That's most elders in America, such as there are any. Fourthly, finally, rejection of the Old Testament for its doctrines of good creation and just wrath. By the way, pick a heretic in the first four centuries, and he has a problem with the goodness of creation and the justness of wrath, and rejects the Old Testament on that basis. And in many cases rejects the incarnation of Christ, because then, of course, God cannot, he would never participate in something corruptible like human flesh. All right, that's the positive argument. There's a negative one. I did my best to summarize it. I think that whole yin and yang picture that you have there is a good enough description of it. But basically, what I mean by arguing negatively, I'll just summarize in 2 minutes. What I mean by arguing negatively is a kind of reductio ad absurdum proof. In other words, you assume the premise of your opponent, and you work it out to its logical conclusion, and the conclusion will be, it will not be this, it'll be, that's the law of non-contradiction, that's right. It'll actually say that A equals non-A, whatever it is. Okay? So good and evil are completely equal in being. If a Manichaean is committed to that over here, say at premise 3, but if you say it that way, if you hold it in front of them, hold up a mirror, they say, no, we don't believe that. Okay? So you show them what their ultimate assumption is, and you'll be revealing to them that in their premises is A equals non-A. That's called a reductio ad absurdum argument. We went over it a little bit in the logic class. That's really what Augustine does. And I showed you that in your notes in a couple different ways, or a couple different areas of thought in which that happens. Finally, why does all this matter today? Well, it matters because we have a very wholesome suburban Manichaeanism alive and well at the beginning of the 21st century. We'll see the same thing about Donatism, and more obviously in our circles you'll recognize Pelagianism. But you'll see that about these others as well. A suburban Manichaeanism at the beginning of the 21st century. For a generation that was raised on George Lucas's science fiction dualism, and that generation that disdains ultimate distinctions of excellence, and which judges success by pragmatic, tangible results, we've got all three of those problems. Raised on dualism in science fiction films. Disdain ultimate distinctions of excellence. Oh, that's so elitist. That's intellectual. That's impractical. That's theoretical. And, flip side of the same coin, pragmatists, we judge success by pragmatic, tangible, physical, in other words, naturalistic results. We may well ask whether or not the assumptions that the most successful men in the church, especially, are they not essentially the foundations of Manichaeanism? In Augustine's refutation of them, we find much wisdom for our refutation against the Manichaeans of the American suburbs that threaten a Reformed revival. So let me open it up to questions, and then we will break. But ask whatever things you want. Yeah. Oh, there's a whole lot of problems with those. But certainly naturalism and pragmatism are built into the modern school system. Naturalism from Dewey. Pragmatism already from Dewey, but also from some of the things like the GI Bill and the space race. A shoved a bunch of people, it's called the vertical invasion of barbarians, a bunch of people into the school system, 10-1, that weren't there. You didn't have enough of a supply of classically trained teachers to soak up the barbarians, in a sense, just unschooled, people that were not before that time traditionally in school, they couldn't soak them up in the culture of the past. We didn't have enough people. The people we did have didn't really believe in it anymore, so Dewey's method won. Then in the 50s, the space race, Sputnik happened. We got to compete with the Soviets. Let's buff up in math and science and get rid of the humanities. Whatever was left of the humanities was out of there. And so you have this education that's built, A, on the past, and B, on a very blip of a past, and B, irrational to begin with. And it's just has bred more and more practices. And then just the regular consumer culture, you know, results now, fast food, TV, our attention span is ever truncated by blips of images and information. We think we're more sophisticated because we have more of a mountain of information. But that glut of information has nothing to do with intelligence. It's like monkeys highly trained fetching landmines, but at the end of the day, it has nothing to do with connecting ideas and drawing circles around ideas, which you need a degree of solitude and permanence for, things we don't have.
Yeah. Another reason why the pagans were interested in subduing their passions, mm-hmm. one more reason, is because God has set up both the physical law and the mental law
yeah.
to attach happiness to virtue
yeah.
and misery to vice.
Yep.
And so when the pagans were not subduing their passions, then Romans 1:27 says that they received in their own persons the due penalty of their error.
Yeah.
So they had a self-preserving stake mm-hmm. in subduing the passions.
Yeah, I will sometimes say, and I've said this to my children, I don't think it's a mistake, but it is a general revelation truth. Any pagan could say the same thing if they got it. And that is, you better order yourself from the inside, because if you don't order yourself from within, people are willing to do it from without. Usually in a jail, or they'll just beat you if you act like that out in society. If you act like this in society, the way you're acting toward your siblings, you will be beaten and thrown in jail. Now that's not my end, that better not be my end argument to them. My end argument is because of what it says about God. How is God's glory at stake here? But, it is true that if you don't find order from within, you will find it from without, with a taser or something like that. So that, yeah, it's a truth of general revelation, and therefore the pagan does see glimpses of that.
Which is helpful for us, too, today. That should be helpful in our evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
That the person in front of me, they might be, with their lips, speaking against all moral law, and in their lives they're definitely doing as well. But there's two truths. Number one, they are miserable because God's attached misery to vice. And secondly, they are receiving within themselves a due penalty for their error. So if we know that when we're speaking to a sinner, it should help inform us on how to use God's law and
yeah.
you know these ancient heresies to
yeah.
speak truth.
It's more of that common ground. And what do you mean by common ground? There's quicksand on common ground. The presuppositionalist says there's nothing but quicksand on common ground, but that's another story. But it's a good study to contrast the way Christians of the past would argue with the way some of the best, maybe Reformed thinkers think today. There'll be some similarities in doctrine, but you'll notice a huge gulf in the area of apologetics and philosophy. There is an anti-philosophy, anti-intellectualism attached to the best Reformed thinkers today, who are the best thinkers in the church. So I'm not addressing the others because there's a total anti-intellectualism there. But we should, as we read Augustine, maybe charitably, and read him actually in his own context, you might ask yourself, where's the repressed quotes? Where's the dualistic quotes? Oh, I can kind of see how they got that out of that. But, for example, Gordon Clark, we're reading Gordon Clark a lot lately, and it's like, man, he talks like, this guy's got an intellectual backbone. I mean, he's at the top of the heap, and yet he still calls Augustine a rationalist, and so on, and you see why, you know why, it will do well for Christians to go back to the original sources and read these guys and ask, A, is it really so? And B, if not, what's behind this ambivalence of Reformed scholars today toward the classical thinkers when they started talking about philosophy? When you dig, and I've dug, and I've dug at places and got to hard objects down there that reveal that it's anti-intellectualism still. Even in some of the best Reformed thinkers.
And that's we talked about the logic class, that the one doctrine that is under attack today, like Luther faced justification, the one doctrine that we have is, like you said, realism.
Mm-hmm.
If If we lose that, we lose everything. And that's why truth itself is the main thing that's under attack.
Yeah. And even those who weren't sure about realism by name, like Charles Hodge deals with this almost parenthetically, and I can't remember the place in systematic theology where he does it. But he actually said, I don't know how good realism makes as a philosophical doctrine, but, and then the rest of his whole paragraph is defending it theologically. Warfield specifically defended it about the doctrine of Christ. Machen in Christianity and Liberalism said, Jesus was a theist. The referent God has to be there before the incarnation. And he was pointing out that how realism, without using the word, is a precondition for Christian theism and therefore the soundness of the rest of our systematic theology. So you had guys as late as the 20th century still thinking this way. Of course, Edwards thinks this way the best, and even Shedd there's some trimming in Shedd that we found, but he still thinks that way. But the people of the past understood that when the castle of realism falls, the whole house of Christendom is going to fall. That doesn't mean the church is going to fall. Jesus' statement in Matthew 16 is absolutely true. Gates of hell will not prevail against it. But the control room of the mind in the seminary will fall at that particular time and place, and that church will eventually go into apostasy. The fabric will unwind over the course of decades and centuries. That's a lot for a first class. But it'll be fun. It'll be a fun class.